Not yet. The email, the prayer request that we had a couple or 3 weeks ago was answered in the affirmative. So if you were praying about the business opportunity that this believer had, that has been taken care of. And secondly, today is February the 20th. This will serve as the first official announcement for the annual business meeting of the members, which will occur next Sunday during second session. Looking at the amount of business that we have, which is minimal, of course, I think we can probably do it in the last half hour. So we'll probably have like a half hour class and then devote the last half hour to the business meeting. So if you intend to attend that, then you have to be a member by next week. Other than that, that is all we have for now. We are ready to resume here with verse 29. Dealing with this woman who had suffered immeasurably, and her faith that if she just got to Jesus and could touch his garments, that she would be healed. And immediately she was. Verse 29, immediately the flow of blood was dried up, and she recognized in her body that she was healed of her affliction. There's a chi here that's not translated. You've got the adverb that Mark uses regularly, euthus. In this case, should be taken in its normative sense of immediately. Sometimes he will use this just to advance the narrative. In this case, I don't think that is the case. He here is dealing with the fact that the second she touched him, she perceived a physical difference that was noticeable to her inside her body. And immediately, the flow is a rhino, literally, of her blood was dried up. You actually have the verb, a rhino, X-E-R-A-I-N-O. A rhino means to stop the flow of something. We have a passive here, aorist passive indicative, hence to be dried up by some outside agent. And in this case, the outside agent is the Lord himself. And the flow of blood was pege, with the definite article, 11 times, P-E-G-E. The source of something that gushes or flows out. Sometimes this word's translated fountain, because it's a source of water, typically, not exclusively, but can be that. And in this case, it's the source of the blood. The flow of her blood, the source of her blood, was hers. Blood is hyma, with a definite article, tell hyma, the neuter of the definite article. Hyma itself is a neuter, genitive neuter singular. And when we talk again, as we've pointed out in the past, we'll mention again here, when we speak of gender in the Greek language and in the Hebrew language, both, we are not talking about sexual gender. There is no sense of that in these languages. There is, I mean, not to say that masculine things aren't typically masculine and females aren't typically feminine. They are. The word for female is feminine. Hegune. Ho-anthropos, the word for man, is masculine. But there are other things when you get into, like, blood. Blood is a neuter. It's neither viewed as masculine or feminine. But these are grammatical genders. They do not relate to sexual gender. Like, you got the word desert, eremos, which is, in the Greek, effeminate. But how is a desert feminine? Well, there isn't really any sense to that at that level. Because these are, and so when people read into this, oh, this is a neuter or this is a feminine, and that affects the interpretation. No. No, it doesn't. It's grammatical gender, and it helps you to understand the flow of the sentence. For instance, here you have a genitive neuter singular, the blood of her. Then you have a genitive feminine singular of autos. Well, her, obviously, is feminine. She's a woman. Aute is the way it looks in the Greek, but it's autos is the vocabulary form. So immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she recognized in her body. She felt is the way they've translated here. I don't like felt because that implies emotion. There's no emotion necessarily attached to this word. The verb is ginosko. G-I-N-O-S-K-O. And that word means to recognize something, to perceive something, to figure something out. It deals with knowledge that one gets. Now, oida, the verb to know, is always found in the perfect tense, for one thing. And that is because the perfect indicates that once you've got knowledge, you've got it. Now, it doesn't speak to how you got that knowledge. Somebody could have told you, you could have figured it out, you could have read it somewhere. We're not really told how the knowledge. Gnosko gets into the ways one gets knowledge. But it focuses on the knowledge, obviously. I mean, she knows this, but it doesn't have anything to do with feelings or emotions. And so I like recognized or figured out way better than felt here. I feel that felt is not necessarily a good translation in this context. So she recognized or figured out in her body. In her body is a locative neuter singular of to, soma. Again, the body is viewed as a neuter. Obviously, her body is female, but the body itself is a neuter noun. That's a pretty good example there, where grammatical gender doesn't affect us. So she recognized or figured out in her body. So obviously she felt something. There was a sensation that she was aware of, what it was. Now, was this flow associated with pain? If it was, then the pain stopped. And that probably is how they arrived at the idea of felt. But we're not told that she felt pain. So we don't really know. But what happens is that she becomes immediately aware in some way. And this appears to be instantaneous. It doesn't take forever. She doesn't go home and say, well, I hope I'm better. She knows right that split second that it's happened. And so whatever the situation was, I mean, whether she could feel this flow, you know, we're not told whether there was pain associated with it, whatever it was. She figured out that, and then Hadi here introduces the content of what she recognized, that she had been healed. Iaomai in the Greek, I-A-O-M-A-I. Here you have the perfect passive indicative. She had been healed with the result that the cure was permanent. I mean, that's the perfect force of the verb. It's action in past time. She had been healed like just a second ago. But the idea is that this healing is going to extend on into the future. That she's not just healed momentarily, in other words. And the passive, of course, indicates an outside agent. She recognized that she had been healed or cured from preposition o, apo rather, plus the, typically it's an ablative, a feminine singular, of mastes, M-A-S-T-I-S. There's another good example. Hey, this is a feminine noun, mastes. How is affliction feminine? I'll let you ponder that one for a moment. It's because it's female, that's why. Females are afflictions, and you have to recognize... No, I'm just kidding, see, that's the joke. There's no sexual gender attached to this. So affliction, literally, this means a scourge. It was the whip they used to beat people with. And very often it was multi-pronged, and it came out, it had a handle and multiple straps, and at the end of the straps were attached pieces of bone, metal, various things. That the scourger would use when applying the scourge to the back of the individual. And so that when he would take it, and as it landed, he would give it a twist, which would cause the stuff to twist into the skin and bring away a lot of flesh. Well, here it's used metaphorically. That's the literal usage of scourge. But here, a condition of great distress, torment, or suffering, as if someone were beating you bloody. That's the idea of it. In her case, literally, the blood was there. So immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And as Kai, not translated, euthus is immediately. And again, I think this is all bang, bang, bang. So in this case, I think euthus should be understood in its normative sense of, you know, immediately this happened. So, okay, so she touches the garment. Immediately she senses she's healed. Jesus senses that power has gone out from him. And so here in the humanity of Jesus Christ, one of the things we have to acknowledge with this passage is that it cost him something to do this. That there was action involved not only on his part, but loss of power that was apparently noticeable to him when he healed somebody. If you can understand the hypostatic union, explain all this to me. That would be nice. I mean, I don't claim to understand all this. Perhaps he perceived that the power of God had gone through his physical body in some way. That's the way I would see it. But what that felt like or any other factor, we're not told. And so immediately Jesus, she recognizes, she's healed. Bang, he recognizes the power's gone out from him. And it happens just that fast, probably within a second or two, both of them. The Jesus, definite article with the proper name, Iesus. And it's not unusual to find the definite article with a name. Sometimes it's used, sometimes it's not. I don't know that there's any specific reason why you could cite a principle that would say why this is this way in every case. It's too random, in my opinion, to be able to necessarily always figure out. But that's, again, one of the subtleties of using the Greek language and languages that are very technical, in that, you know, you have to know what the limitations of the technicalities are. And, you know, even a technical language has its limitations. So Jesus, and then you got here epigenosko, which is a strengthened form. Epigenosko. Epigenosko, and again, aorist active participle here. So this verb is going to precede the action of the main verb. Having perceived, and epigenosko, genosko, if genosko means to figure something out, the strengthened form of it means to figure it out perfectly, to really understand it, to grasp it. And that's the distinction that we make in these verbs of having knowledge and figuring something out. I mean, Jesus knew it instantaneously. Just knew it as clear as anything you ever knew in your life. So he completely recognized what's happened. In himself is preposition in plus the locative masculine singular of the reflexive pronoun heautou. H-E-A-U-T-O-U. Within himself, that power, and they supplied the word that here, but that's fine, because typically you will have a word like that with a verb of knowledge, because it usually typically supplies the content of that knowledge, whether it's hadi or hina, both can be used, hadi more often. The power is dunamis, and power, this means exactly that, power. And typically, a lot of times, this word will even be translated miracle, because it gets into the idea of the power necessary to perform a miracle. But here, that power from him, preposition ek plus the ablative masculine singular of autos, from him, had gone forth or departed as ex erkomai, the simple verb erkomai with the prefix ek, ex in the linguistic here part of it. So ex erkomai, to go out or depart, knowing that power from him had departed. Again, an aorist active participle, this all precedes the action of the main verb, which is here he said. And the main verb is lego down there, and said, that's the main verb. You have, again, these series of participles building up to the main verb, giving you what's going on in Jesus' thinking. Obviously, this has to be done. Either Jesus had to stop later on and explain to Peter what he was thinking, or this is simply the ministry of the Holy Spirit informing Mark about what Jesus thought. There's only two options here as far as I can see it. That Jesus later explained all this to people. How did you know me? And this would be a good question. One might figure that the disciples would ask, well, how did you know that this had happened? I mean, there were so many people crowding around us, and multiple people touched you. How did you know this one was different? Jesus would have probably stopped and explained it to them. Well, I feel this or that when healings are occurring. So if he told Peter, this is knowledge that Peter would have had that he passed on to Mark. Other than that, then it has to be simply the ministry of the revelation of the Holy Spirit. Mark couldn't have known this by himself. So you have, kind of only one or two options here. So he recognized that power had gone forth from him, having turned around, literally. Epistrepho is a verb. It's a participle, though. E-P-I-S-T-R-E-P-H-O is the verb. Having turned around, again, the aorist passive participle, although this may, in this context, be deponent, because you obviously participate in the action, or a middle. Being turned around, literally, but obviously some outside force didn't turn him around. I mean, he turned around on his own. So, again, I would probably see this more likely as a middle. In the middle of the crowd. In the crowd is the way they've translated it, in the midst of, preposition and plus the word aklos. And said, now the only difference here is you want to change this, he kept saying. It's an imperfect active indicative. He asked, and the idea here is he asked repeatedly. And the sense of it is the woman didn't come forward immediately the first time he asked, who touched me? Which one of you touched me? Then the woman's kind of like, she's probably already backing up as fast as she can. Who knows? She wants to sink back into the crowd. And so Jesus asks again, who touched me? And my suspicion is that he became more insistent on this as he was asking, although you can't necessarily glean that just simply from the language here. But I know how I would be. I mean, I think I know what the typical human response would be if somebody did something. Who did, you know, like a parent dealing with children. Who did this? And it's not always just, no, come on, tell me who did this. It gets more insistent as, you know, the parent doesn't find out. And I got to presume that Jesus is because, and he stops the whole situation too. It isn't just that he turned around, obviously, and we do know that he turned around, but he stopped before he turned around. The impression I have is he's walking along, all of a sudden he feels this, he stops, spins it on his heel, says, who touched me? And he's looking around at the crowd, and the crowd standing there thinking, what? I mean, because they have no idea what's going on. The disciples have no idea what's going on. Only Jesus and the woman know. So there's only two people in this entire crowd that know what happened. And yet a great miracle has taken place. And God, you know, doesn't, as it were, doesn't broadcast it. Nobody knew. And so Jesus asks, and he keeps on asking. Lego is the verb here. He kept on asking is the idea, although the verb lego simply means to say. But clearly he poses an interrogative here, so you know, you can translate Lego in this context as he kept on asking, who touched my garments? Interrogative pronoun here in the masculine, tis, and as we would expect, it is masculine, because here's what we can glean from this. While the humanity of Christ was conscious of the power transfer that had been involved in healing, the humanity of Christ wasn't privy to who did it. He didn't know who he had healed. He knew he had healed somebody, but he didn't know who he had healed. And so why make all this big show out of this? Why stop this entire procession? I mean, he's in the middle of going to heal a deadly ill girl. And so he just stops. Well, you know what Jairus is thinking. Which one of you idiots touched him? I mean, he's probably put out by this. And it's very clear that the disciples are put out by it. For what, you know, whyever they are. But again, if put yourself back in the minds of the disciples, the last 48 hours for them have been, you know, 24 plus, at least, have been pretty rough, we might say. I mean, they were likely up early the previous morning, endured that whole day of teaching, got, you know, had a question and answer session with Jesus, went across the sea, encountered the storm, freaked out, saw the demoniac, freaked out over that, come back across the sea, there's this big crowd, and now they're met with this, and so they literally almost have no time to breathe. And one of the things we're going to see later on is that Jesus was cognizant of the pressure his disciples were under. And so he provides for them a time and a space. He will pull them away from the crowds from time to time just to give them time to kind of get their wits together, get their wits about them, and be able to continue on. I mean, these are men for whom all of this is just so far beyond the pale of their ordinary existence that, I mean, there's just no way to even, I think, understand the impact on these men. So he turns around and says, and the pronoun is masculine, as one would expect here, although we know it's a woman. But Jesus didn't know it was a woman. That's why it's a masculine pronoun. He just uses the general form you would use. Who, me, touched the garments of me, literally. Then this is forward in some ways in the Greek and separated from the word garments with which it goes, my garments, who of me touched the garments? And so you have a little bit different emphasis. The me is sort of forward in it to draw attention to him. So it's all about Jesus, right? Well, actually it is. In this case, it always is. Touched is hopto. The verb means exactly that, to make contact, to touch. And then hemation in the plural, garments. Much as we use, you know, the word clothing itself can be a singular or a plural, kind of depending upon how you, you know, use it. Same like with fruit, you know. It's singular or plural, depending upon what you have. I got a piece of fruit, and we pick fruit today. Well, fruit in that context is a plural. So you have that here too. So garments here, plural, although she only touched the outer garment. She didn't, wasn't like she, you know, molested him or touched him, fondled him, and got all over him. She just touched the outer garment. And apparently maybe a part that was just hanging loose, whether it was the hem of the garment, his sleeve. We don't know what part she touched. We just know she touched him. And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" So essentially, without saying it, they're kind of saying, "Jackass." And that's their attitude at this point. Right? I mean, they're a little put out with Jesus. And his disciples, and his chi, actually have the verb forward, lego, were saying, or kept on saying. So in other words, not just one disciple said this. You know, all of them kind of adopted, or the ones that were close enough to do all this, kind of adopted this, "Are you kidding me?" attitude with Jesus. Are you kidding me? You've got to be kidding me. So they kept on asking. Again, you have an imperfect, him. They kept on saying to him, dative of altas, Jesus, the disciples of him. Mathetes means exactly that, a disciple, a student, a learner. And as a rabbi, as a teacher in Israel, he attracted followers. These followers were known as mathetes. Disciples or learners. Students, his students. And that's all they are, students. See, people get this sort of religious idea of disciples. Well, there is a religious element to it, but they're involved with Jesus as a teacher. And so his disciples said to him, "You see," present active indicative, you can keep on seeing, by the way. You can observe the crowd, aklos, crowding around you. And they've translated it pressing in on you, which is sunthlebo. Two times we saw it earlier. Means literally to rub together with. S-U-N. Thlebo, this is where the word Greek term actually tribulation comes from. Thlipsis is from this root. And it means that which constricts, that which confines, that which rubs on somebody, that which causes pressure. And then soon means to rub together with something. So you see the crowd pushing in on you or pressing in on you. Against you is accusative of here of sue, against you. And has the idea of against or up against. And you say, "Can't believe you're saying this, Lord. You should know better." That's kind of their... You should know better than this. I mean, even I can see this. And you should know this. You're the Lord. But one of the things you see is that they didn't always appreciate who they were talking to or who they were dealing with. This is part of the nature of... this is part of the suffering of the kenosis. Here's God in the flesh. And they're treating him like he's kind of an idiot. And Jesus had to put up with this. This is not the only time, by the way, they do this. This was kind of a regular feature that he had to put up with in the angelic conflict. That, you know, here he is, the greatest person who's ever lived and ever will live. And yet people treat him like he's an idiot, like he doesn't know what he's doing. Or that his questions are nonsensical, as they treat him here. This is a stupid question. I mean, that's kind of what they were thinking. This is a stupid question. And so, you say, "Who touched me?" You say is lego here. You are saying, or are you asking... I mean, it's kind of, again, they're a little incredulous. Who, me, touched? Interrogative pronoun again, who, of tis, me, ego, and then touched is hopto, again, the verb. All right, point one, although no single account and contains all the facts about this encounter, a few things should be remembered about this incident. A, the woman was an outcast in Jewish culture, being referred to as Zava. and was socially not much different than the leper. B, if she had been married, and there is no indication in the text. Again, this could have started with her first menstrual cycle and never stopped. So, I mean, although they did marry early in that culture, it doesn't appear that she was married, from what I can tell. But if she was, her husband would have divorced her by now. And her friends and family would have shunned her. See, she would have been excommunicated from the services of the synagogue and would also have been barred from the woman's courts in the temple. D, therefore, like the leper, she lived a life of lonely, horrible, forced isolation with no hope of reprieve. And loneliness is a bad thing. And God recognizes this early on. We know from the scripture there when you read the Genesis account, as you read God, as he restored the planet in seven literal days, a sixth actually, but he rested the seventh. And the seventh day he called the Sabbath. So this is what also tells me it's literal days. Because the seventh day God rested, and that's the Sabbath, and we know that's Saturday. So how do I know these are literal days? Well, there's a number of tips in Genesis that tell you this is seven literal days. Seven 24-hour periods in which God restores planet Earth for our inhabitants, for its new inhabitants. And on the seventh day, God rested. Why? Because he was so tired. No, obviously he wasn't tired. That's not why he rested. He rested as an object lesson in the doctrine of rest. So that we recognize that there is a rest for the people of God. And so as he goes through the book of Genesis there in chapter 1, what do you get? God, day 1, God manufactured the lights. And by the way, and when you go into Genesis and you start studying the nature of the verbs, that's very important because you have the verb bara, to create ex nihilo, to create out of nothing, and then you have the verb asa, to make or manufacture. And then you even have another verb in there used, bana, and that means to build. So he baras, God, in the beginning, God baras the heaven and the earth. He speaks them into existence. Boom. There it is, the whole creation. And then, of course, the creation comes under judgment, as we know, through the fall of Satan. And then God begins to re-fix the world. He packs the world in ice, in a watery ball, freezes it, withdraws heat from it. And therefore, boom, the earth is frozen. And then you see the Spirit of God hovering over the surface of the deep. And so then he uses asa, and this word means to manufacture from existing materials. This one, and it doesn't always mean this, because it's a little asterisk there, it's not always technical. But in Genesis it is. It means to manufacture out of nothing, to speak into existence. And asa means to make out of existing material. So if you take something and you build something, say out of 2x4s, a doghouse, you wouldn't use bara for that, you would use asa. I bara'd a doghouse. You would only say you bara'd it if you spoke it into existence. Doghouse. And there's a doghouse. That's bara. But an asa, if you use a hammer and nails and wood, well, then you've asa'd it, you've built it out of existing materials. And then you've got bana, and this one's actually applied to the woman. The woman was literally built, to coin a phrase. So if you looked at Eve, you would have said, wow. I mean, she was a specimen, the best specimen of a woman likely that ever existed. And so, because she's, you know, she's created perfect. And not just, you know, perfect physically and spiritually, but physically. And so that he uses that word for her. He built the woman. So you got three verbs used there, but anyway, when he's doing all this, he starts using asa after verse 1. He doesn't use bara again over and over. He doesn't keep speaking things into existence. He's working with existence materials, with existing materials. And when he works with existing materials, he says it was good. Everything he creates, he says it was good, good, good. Day 7, at the end of the day, God looked around and said, good. Day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, 6, good. And it was all good. And then he sums it up at the end of day 6 with, it's very good. And then the only thing you find out that's not good in Genesis 1, there's one thing that's not good, and that's loneliness. It is not good for the man to be alone. And so therefore, this woman endures what is not good. Even from God's perspective, it's not good. So that is, again, what she faced. Two, we are not told specifically what this woman thought of or knew about Jesus Christ, but we are told that she was firmly convinced that a simple touch of his garments would be sufficient to provide a complete healing. Which the fact that she can even have faith by this time is kind of an amazing deal given what she's gone through. I mean, one could readily just give up hope and put an end to it all by this point. You might think, well, this woman could be suicidal. Well, she's endured, you know, I would think after 12 years of just horrible, horrific suffering. You know, maybe some of you here have been through something for 12 years like this, but I haven't. And I doubt that any of us have. 12 years of just mind-numbing, ongoing, no hope of reprieve suffering. And yet she still has faith at the end of it all, which is kind of, that's kind of neat. It speaks to her positive volition there. So three, therefore, it matters little whether she thought that Jesus Christ was the Messiah or simply a miracle worker. She simply had faith that touching his garments was sufficient to remedy her situation. And as we find out, God honors faith. And then four, as she approached Jesus Christ, repeating her mantra to bolster her confidence, she finally succeeded in touching the garments she believed would bring deliverance to her. And five, from the accounts of Matthew and Luke, we know that she grasped the fringe or bottom tassel of his outer garment. Now that we find out in Matthew 9:20. I said earlier we don't know. Well, we don't know from Mark's account what she touched. But Matthew and Luke spell it out for us. Matthew 9:20. And a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak, which tells us that it was not only the outer garment, it was the very edge of it, the hem of it, we might say. And then Luke, in Luke 8:44, in his parallel, says the very same thing. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak, and immediately her hemorrhage stopped. And six, both authors indicate that she touched the fringe of his cloak, which refers to one of the borders of the outer garments that all Jews wore. Every devout male Jew, I mean all Jews, male Jews specifically, because we're dealing with Jesus here. Every devout male Jew wore an outer robe with four tassels on it, having one at each corner. These tassels were born in obedience to the command in Numbers. Now that's found in Numbers 15:38. And even with this, you see that the Jews were very literal about their compliance with what they perceived to be God's will in His Word. Unfortunately, all deteriorated into legalism, but Numbers here, 15:38 through 40, speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corner of their garments. Throughout their generations, and they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, as you do with them, and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you play the harlot. And so you may remember, so that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy to your God. And so they put these four blue tassels on the edge of their outer garments. Now, why blue? Well, typically when you deal with the understanding of typology and the ceremonial code of the Jews, blue tends to point to, when you look up, what do you see? You see blue sky. And the idea of it is it's heavenward. And the whole point of these tassels was to keep their mind on God who is in heaven, not on what they could see. And that's why he differentiates here in verse 39, so that you do not follow after your own heart and your own eyes. He's differentiating between what you can see and hear and smell and think in this temporal world versus the eternal world that God lives in. And blue typically symbolizing the heavenly origin of Messiah, although not exclusively. In this case, I think it's more just a reminder of the heavenly versus the earthly. And I don't know that it had anything to do with Messiah, quote, in this context. It's more just to get them to remember that you're a heavenly people here on planet Earth. Which, of course, obviously is even more true of us today. That we are strangers and aliens passing through. If you're trying to get comfortable in this world, you are screwing up by the numbers. Because this world is not your home. You are simply passing through here. And so we get by in this world, and we understand God can prosper us and bless us and make our lives comfortable, but very often that's only related to our doctrinal orientation. And the things that come out of that, as we see, say, Psalm 1, you read there about the positive believer who's oriented, applies the doctrine of separation, and is planted permanently by a stream and has sufficient doctrine and water and all that the tree needs there to grow into a good example of what a positive believer can be. And so we are a heavenly people living in this world, just as the Jews are. And we're not to forget that. You're only passing through. You're only a stranger on this planet. As Leon said, you're a stranger in a strange land. And that's the way it is. So don't try to get too comfortable here. This is why we don't try to fit in with the cosmos. Now, we don't go out of our way and be weird. Don't dress weird and act weird. But we recognize that these are realities. And B, they were to remind the individual that the one wearing it was a member of the chosen people of God, and was to remember and practice his commandments. Again, to differentiate between the heavenly and the earthly. Several interpreters have wondered why the woman did not approach Jesus Christ directly and simply ask for healing. But there are a couple of good reasons why she did not. First, if someone in the crowd had recognized her, that person would most likely have made a scene and attempted to flee her presence. Well, pandemonium could have erupted in the first place. So why be surreptitious about this? Well, obviously, people could have gone nuts in this situation. I mean, a stampede could literally have occurred, crushing Jesus and anybody that was in the way. Now, obviously, God didn't allow that to happen. And here you see in the providential leading of God and in his Son. And you'll see it at times in your own life, that God providentially has you in a particular place at a particular time, and things just fall into place. And that's the way it's supposed to be. So again, they would have made a scene, no doubt, disrupted this whole thing and turned it into chaos. Secondly, if her hemorrhage was a vaginal one, which again seems to me to be the most likely explanation, the very personal nature of such a condition would likely have prompted her decision to approach him from behind, rather than making the matter public before all assembled. I mean, do you really want to walk up and tell Jesus this in front of all these people? Hey, I've got a problem. But no, that would probably be, I mean, when it comes to the private parts aspects, the genitals, we recognize first from Genesis, and then right on through the Bible, that shame, there's a certain shame attached to this. Legitimate shame. That's why we don't go naked. This is why Jesus didn't promote nudity. Join the nudist camp. No. That's just so wrong, it's not even funny. People say, well, it's harmless. No, it's not. It's a total violation of God's plan. When he dressed Adam and Eve, he didn't tell them, well, keep these on till you feel like it. He dressed them permanently. And obviously there's significance in what he did, but spiritual significance. But the physical significance is that you stay dressed. And so I can understand why she wouldn't have wanted to run out and make this public. And then 10, nevertheless, the circumstances of this day, with the massive crowds pressing in on Jesus Christ and those with him, allowed her to make her approach in her weakened condition. See, I assume they're moving pretty slow because of all this situation. That Jesus is kind of having to make his way slowly through this crowd, that it's not happening quickly. Well, this works to her advantage because she is weak. She's got to be. I mean, there's no way she couldn't be. But she can make this approach now without drawing attention to herself. 11, this is a good example of the providential working of God, since the events of this day unfolded in such a way as to allow all this to come together. Now, we know that God knows in eternity past everything that's going to happen. So this allows him to concoct, as it were, we don't use that word advisedly, because God always had his plan with him. But knowing of what's going to happen allows God to make every provision so that these things unfold just the way he wants them to. And there's a certain sense in which life is unfolding just the way God wants it to. So when we get out of sorts and out of fellowship and cranky and all of that, we kind of know, well, we're a little bit at odds with God because his world's unfolding. We have to say the divine decree going from eternity past to eternity future is happening just like God wants. The big plan here. And then down here in time, Well, you got all this stuff going on. I mean, it can be all over the place. Up to and including, as we're going to find out, horrible evil. And you know, there's always evil on the planet. But then here towards the end, it gets, you know, like that, goes off the chart with evil. And so as we observe God's plan, well, God brings all these things together. He knew where this woman would be. He knew where his son would be. And he knew she had faith. And so therefore, all of this works together so that this great miracle can occur. And I mean, what if Jesus had been moving that day at they'd gone off lickety-split. And they're making, 5 or 6 miles an hour. I don't think she could have caught him. I don't think there's any way she could have caught him. Given her weakened condition and all that. So again, God brings all this together as his eternal plan designs. And 12, as with all the healings or cures that Jesus Christ provided, this one was also instantaneous and complete. The adverb euthus immediately should be understood in the normative sense of at once. Again, Mark uses it, I think, as a temporal marker to advance the narrative. But in this case, I don't think he's using it that way at all. And immediately, this happened immediately. This is further confirmed by Luke's use of the adverb parakrema, which has a similar meaning of immediately, at once, or without delay. Although Luke uses a different adverb here to describe it, means the same thing, essentially. And 14, not only did the blood stop flowing, the underlying problem that was causing her symptoms was immediately healed. Now, we don't know what that was. We have no idea what it was. Neither did she, obviously. But she knows something when it happens, when the healing occurs. She knows something's happened. She knows that it stopped. 15, the rather picturesque phrase, the flow of her blood, has a Hebrew equivalent. And is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew phrase in Exodus. That's used in, or Leviticus rather, I'm sorry. Leviticus 12:7. Which also gets into a vaginal flow of blood. And that's, again, why the interpreters largely lean towards a vaginal problem here. Or not a problem, but that's at least where the blood, that's where the flow was going through. 12:7, and he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the flow of her blood. And this is the law of her who bears a child, whether male or female. This gets into, in verse 5, she will be unclean for 2 weeks as in her menstruation. And she will remain in the blood of her purification for 66 days. So 16, Mark uses the verb zeirino to stop the flow of something or to dry it up, to reinforce the truth that this woman's affliction was healed at its very source. 17, additionally, the use of the Greek term pege, fountain or spring, emphasizes the copious amount of bleeding from which this woman suffered. When you see that word, pege, again, very often it can be translated as fountain. Fountains don't trickle. They flow under some pressure, and that's the idea of it, that there's a lot of it and there's a certain amount of pressure associated with it. And 18, although we are not told precisely what her bodily experience was, Mark makes it plain that as soon as she succeeded in touching Jesus' garments, the woman was aware of the fact that something significant had happened to her. And 19, there was some definitive bodily sensation, which she clearly perceived, that made it evident to her that her affliction and the torment associated with it was now over. And of course, how do you feel right then if you're her? Real good. And then all of a sudden, now I'm called on the carpet. So her rejoicing here at this moment was kind of short-lived. It didn't last very long. I mean, obviously she feels real good immediately. She's very happy. And then all of a sudden Jesus starts making an issue out of it. So my suspicion is that that joy immediately turns to embarrassment and fear because he's calling her out publicly. And now whether she thinks she can get away with this or not, and my guess is, of course, this was her plan. She was going to sneak up, touch Jesus, and run, essentially. You know, and go, and nobody would ever know, and she would be healed, and it would all be fine. But that wasn't the plan. And as we're going to see, Jesus does this for some specific reasons. He doesn't just embarrass her publicly for no reason. There is a reason behind it. 20, Mark uses the verb gnosko, which means to acquire knowledge by some means. To recognize, to figure out, to perceive, notice, or realize. And 21, although Mark records her recognition of her healing now, it is likely that this information actually came to light at the end of this incident, when she finally told Jesus the entire story. Now, if you look ahead into verse 33 here, the woman, fearing and trembling, so we know immediately, of course, all of her whatever joy and all that, immediately was replaced with fear because she gets called out, aware of what had happened to her. And there it's reemphasized for us that she knew about this. Came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So again, when we read it in our verse, the woman felt that she was healed of her affliction. That's Mark reading back in some information for us that was really brought out at a later time. When she explained the story publicly, that's how this came to be known. So 22, given the circumstances immediately surrounding this event, it is evident that no one thought anything about the fact that the woman had reached out and grabbed the fringe of Jesus' garment. Now, did anybody see it? We don't know. But even if they did, it would seem unlikely that they thought anything of it. And it doesn't appear to me from the natural reading of this that she grabbed it hard enough so that anyone would have... In other words, she didn't... Like, if you come up and grab me by the shirt, I'm probably going to know. But it appears that she touched this in such a way as to... You wouldn't have known it. That Jesus wouldn't have known it. He wouldn't have felt it. Wasn't as though she grabbed it and suddenly his cloak was spinning around on him and she realized, oh my God, I'm caught. I think it was just a matter, I mean, all she had to do was reach out and touch it. So I don't think she even grabbed it necessarily at all. There's another verb for that. You would maybe expect krateo there rather than hopto if she grabbed it, because that means to seize something or to take hold of it. So my guess is she just touched it. So there's no way, even if anybody saw it, nobody would have thought a thing about it. It would absolutely have just been one little deal that happened. So 23, although her faith is lacking at some level and has a bit of a superstitious quality to it, it should be recognized that it was still her faith that motivates her actions. See, she's acting out of faith here. She's not acting out of unbelief. She's acting out of belief. And 24, this demonstrates that one does not always have to be perfect in his understanding and viewpoint to access the grace of God. Well, that's a good thing. Or none of us would ever be able to. God's grace is available to those that manifest even the weakest faith. Matthew 12:20 deals with that. And that's the verse I alluded to earlier. Or no, actually, this is a different one, but... This is one we had looked at in another context. This is a parallel to another passage in Mark. But a battered reed he will not break off, and a smoldering wick he will not put out. Well, what are those dealing with? What is he getting at here? Well, this gets into the positive volition and the faith of people, however small it may be, however beat up it may be. The battered wick would symbolize one that had really been taken a beating, we might say. Or the battered reed, rather. He won't break off. And a smoldering wick he will not put out. Even if that wick's got just a little bit of spark to it, it's not completely out yet. He doesn't take the snuffer and say, well, that's good enough, you're done. He allows for even the tiniest exercise of faith. So when you see all of this, what does this tell us? This tells us that the human race is without excuse. This is another reason they are without excuse. Because if God allows for even the weakest of faith to succeed, then when people don't exercise faith, well, that's on them. Because God is clearly, and in this incident, I think this brings out as much as anything, this incident that even the smallest amount of faith is good sometimes. It's like you're playing Texas Hold'em. You got an ace high. Well, that's good sometimes. You say, well, the board didn't pair. I don't have a pair. Sometimes ace high is good. A little bit of faith, that's all it takes sometimes. Don't have to have the best hand. Don't have to flop a boat every time, if you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, then you don't. You don't have to flop an obviously winning hand, is what I'm saying. You don't have to get that every time when you're playing cards. Well, in life, you don't have to have the best hand every time. All you have to do is exercise even the smallest amount of faith, and God will meet you. That's the whole point. God honors faith. And when people don't exercise faith, they've got no excuse. Because there's too many stories like this. And of course, we believe that these stories are all true. These aren't made-up stories. This isn't just the ramblings of an incoherent idiot, as some people would tend to view the Gospels. This isn't just some fiction made up to palm off on the human race. These things really happened. And these people are real. And one other thing I see about it is that they manifest that they're all too real. They're just as human as you and I are. And again, we read back and we think, well, yeah, well, Jesus did that then, but he's not interested in me now. Yeah, he is. Of course he is. He's no respecter of persons. So if you recognize and avail yourself of even the weakest amount of faith, God's going to honor it. And obviously, when you don't, God doesn't bless that. You have to recognize. Well, 25, one wonders what the woman actually believed about her healing as she approached Jesus initially. Did she believe that the healing would be instantaneous or complete? Or did she expect it to take some time? Well, we're really not told what her view was. I think this took her by surprise too, though. It's kind of my take on it from reading this. That she wasn't quite expecting what actually happened. And she has this faith that if she touches Jesus, she'll be healed. But then when it actually happens, it's like, did she think she was going to have to go home and wait a few weeks and then everything would be all right? I mean, there are certain types of things where the healing is instantaneous and other healing takes some time. So what she thought, we don't know. But I think again, that she's shocked by this. I think that she's even taken aback by how fast it all worked. But this is an object lesson to her and to everybody who watches it. How much faith do you need and how long does it take for God to bless it? The answer is very little and none. It doesn't take any time for God to bless it. But that's the whole thing. It has to be what we would call biblical faith. And again, we separate faith, pistis, from gnosis, knowledge. People can know a lot of things, but they don't necessarily act on them. They don't necessarily believe them. So 26, in either case, what happened occurred so quickly that only she and Jesus noticed the fact that a complete healing had taken place. And obviously I got a problem. His word has got real problems. This can't be me. That next one should have been 27, but just no point in changing all those numbers. So our time is up. We're going to stop there anyway. So we will continue on dealing with this woman and her, seriously, what she had to perceive to be a wonderful encounter with Jesus. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to assemble together and consider the issues of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.